And we're also pleased to welcome back to the program here Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. And as part of our regular rotation here on every other month basis, he stops by to take health care questions, sort of general questions. And that really is the idea behind these programs. In his practice, he sees people of all ages, grown-ups and kids, and sees people with a lot of different sorts of problems. And we thought, well, it would be a good thing. You know, we do have specialists from time to time on the show, but it would be a good thing to have somebody who is a more of a generalist who could deal with a wide range of things. So if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to give us a call and discuss your concerns with the doctor. I do like to remind people whenever we have physicians on the program that we can't diagnose over the telephone. There are some limits as to what we can do. But I don't want to discourage anybody from calling because it's an information resource for you, an educational one. And if you have some questions, you can call in, and I know that he will do his best to answer your question. And then, of course, if you have concerns, well, you need to pursue them with your own doctor or someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. At any point here, we'll just take as many callers as we possibly can. Welcome back.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
Something I thought I might ask you about, and I don't know what sort of news you have on this, has to do with the flu vaccine for the coming season. People will remember what happened last year. There was a problem with some of the vaccine, and there wasn't enough for everyone to have a shot. I think we certainly talked about it, and there was plenty of discussion in the media that people were advised that if you were in one of the high-risk groups, there was vaccine, and you should go to your doctor and get the shot. But that for everybody else who just wanted to get the shot because they didn't want to get the flu, we said, well, good luck. Do what you can to avoid exposure. Take care of yourself. And we were lucky that actually it turned out that it was not a very bad flu season at all.
That's correct.
So now I'm wondering, this time around, I would expect that people who make the vaccine, the manufacturing process should be going on right now. I mean, they should be, if not already completed and have it sitting in a bottle on the shelf. Do we think that this fall there's going to be a vaccine for everybody who wants to get a shot?
It is anticipated that the previous problems with the manufacturers of the vaccine will have fixed their problems and that there should be an adequate supply for everyone who wants to get one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but I guess last time we sort of found out at the last minute, so we really don't know.
Every day is different, but at this point, things should be on track. And one of the things that didn't get taken advantage as much as perhaps it could have been was the flu vaccine that's available as the nasal spray. Mm-hmm. It is indeed an effective medication, but it's something that was relatively new. People weren't all that familiar with, and in terms of price, was indeed more expensive than the regular flu vaccination.
And was it not also the case, do I remember this right, that there was a, if you got that, there was a very slight chance that you could actually give, somebody could get the flu from being in contact with you. So that certain people were who sort of said, well, if this conditions these conditions apply to you, then you probably shouldn't get this.
That's correct. The flu shot is using a killed virus, so there is no potential for the individual who's immunized to give the active disease to anyone else. The flu mist or nasal spray is using an inactivated but not completely dead a virus to stimulate immunity in those who are thought to be otherwise healthy. But if they themselves came in contact with someone who was sufficiently immunosuppressed, a cancer patient on suppressive chemotherapy, an AIDS patient with a low level of natural immunity, there was some very slight potential risk that an active influenza disease could be transmitted to those individuals.
Mm-hmm. But if you were otherwise healthy, and everybody in your family was otherwise healthy, so that there would be no reason for somebody like that to really have any concerns about getting that version of the...
Correct.
Okay. We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. And they are in Rantoul on our line one. Hello. Is the caller there? Yes, go ahead.
I'm taking pills for supposedly the old shaky disease, you know? And it's... I'm not so sure if it's right to miss it or not, because I can't seem to get over the fact that I'm dizzy all the time.
I'm sorry, sir. I didn't catch the first part of your comment. You're taking medication for what?
Oh, it's supposed to be for not Alzheimer's, but the other one. Shaky disease.
Parkinson's disease?
Yeah.
Okay. And there are actually a number of different medications used for that condition. Can you be a little bit more specific about what you're taking?
Not right at the present time. I left some pills at home.
Oh.
I'm on a cell phone.
Okay.
But is it normal for that stuff to make you dizzy?
As a potential side effect, there are medications used to treat Parkinson's that are sometimes associated with a temporary drop in blood pressure that can indeed make individuals dizzy, especially if they change their position quickly. And in those particular settings, we usually tell folks to get up slowly and make sure that they, feel like they're not going to get dizzy and fall down before they move around.
That's what I heard before, but mine stays with me all the time.
If you're concerned that this represents a side effect of the medication, then I think you need to simply go back to your physician and make them aware of your concern and see if this particular condition that you're aware of right now is indeed related to your medication, or whether it can be altered by changing the dose or by switching the medication.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, the caller raises this question of side effects from medications, or what we think we might be having side effects from medication.
And as we tell people, any medication that has effects does indeed have side effects. There are no medications without them. The question becomes, will a given individual have them to a sufficient degree that it negates the effects that you want from the medication?
Mm-hmm.
So there is no free lunch. When people say, give me that prescription that doesn't have any side effects, I say, well, even placebos have been reported during studies to have, quote, side effects, even though they're, quote, inert medications. So there is no such thing as medication without side effects. You need to understand that in all instances, there's a trade-off between hopefully gaining the benefits, the effects of a medication, versus the potential downside of experiencing side effects. And in some instances, after discussion, people may decide the nature of whatever condition I'm dealing with is not so severe, not so bad, not so potentially worrisome that it needs a medication, because potentially the side effects might be as bad as what I'm suffering from right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's not necessarily a pill for everything. And if there is a pill for everything, there's going to be a potential downside to that same medication. And the biggest difficulty that we have is that it is impossible to predict for any given individual what their response to a medication is going to be. And in many instances, you'll simply have to take the medication and find out. And if that doesn't work, then you go back to square one and say, well, do I need any medication at all? Or perhaps I would do better with, you know, a different type of medication. And we run into this, you know, all the time, because so much of at least American medicine is focused on, well, I have an illness. What's the pill do I take for that? When in fact, many instances, a pill may not be the best answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you even say you have a given medication, and say you have identified that dizziness is a potential side effect? Can you even say that to a patient? Well, 10% or 20% or, you know, even something like that of the people who have taken this have that kind of side effect.
Mm-hmm. You can. And these are, this is information that's based on the clinical studies that all medications go through to gain FDA approval. When medications are in the testing phase, the study population reports absolutely everything that they experience while taking the medication. And, you know, if somebody says, while taking this medication, I got hit in the head with a rock, they write down potential side effect, getting hit in the head with a rock.
No, they don't.
Yeah, they do.
Oh, they do. Oh, okay.
I mean, seriously, there are things that are so far removed from the medication that there's no possible way that it can be a side effect of the medication, but it's an adverse reaction that occurred to that patient while they were taking the drug. And so if you look in a standard, like the PDR, the physician's desk reference, and you look under side effects or adverse reactions, you will find an entire list that just goes on for miles for every single drug ever taken by anybody. That if you ever read that first, you'd never take another pill in your life. But most of them are either anecdotal or occur with such small frequency that, you know, it's not worth throwing the pill away and say, well, it's not good for anything. Most medications do work well with minimal side effects. But again, it's just based on statistical data for large populations, and for a given individual may not be relevant at all. You know, there may be medications that frequently have side effects, and somebody does really well with it and says, I don't notice anything at all. It does what it's supposed to, and I don't have any problem. That's great. Yeah. The flip side can also be true. There are certain medications that are almost uniformly well-tolerated, and yet somebody says, I didn't feel good while I was taking it. That's possible.
Yeah. Well, where I don't know what most dispensers are doing. Certainly where I go and get my prescriptions filled, when they give it to you, they give you a printout that says, listen, this is what the medication is. This is what it's for. If there are special directions about how they want you to take it, and then also potential side effects.
And the other thing that needs to be included in that list is potential interactions with other medications.
Right. So if you're taking these, don't take these things together if you're taking them, that sort of thing. And so I'm wondering, though, is there any benefit? Now, if somebody wants to even find out more, I mean, they can go to the library and they can look at the physician's desk reference, which will have even more information than probably in you'll be given by your dispenser.
Right.
And there are also books available. You can actually go out and buy them that essentially have that same kind of information in them. Do you think that there's any value for someone to actually go for themselves, to go the extra step and to look at that other stuff, or that's just going to be confusing for most people.
I think for most people, if they read all of that information, they probably wouldn't take any medications for any purpose because the potential list of side effects is so long. And as I said, is simply a list of all of the adverse things that occurred during testing, or in some cases, things that came to light after the drug was approved and was used in larger patient populations. People need to realize that, you know, a drug study might involve 10,000 people, but when marketed, may be given to millions of people. So in a study over a relatively short period of time with 10,000 people, that one in a million adverse event may not show up. And may not show up until the drug's been in use for a couple of years, and that there have been literally millions of people take it so that those couple of cases can show up. And then it's a question of figuring out, well, was it really the medication that caused it? There are things that we don't know yet about medications in terms of side effects because they haven't been out there long enough. They haven't been used in large enough populations yet. And so there's always this, you know, sort of risk-benefit analysis that needs to go on. A number of medications that seem to be quite efficacious for certain conditions, you know, people say, well, can I take this for 50 years? And the answer is, who knows? It's only been out for five. Nobody has 50 years worth of data on this particular medication. One of my sort of favorite examples when I talk in the office with at least female patients is the whole theory behind estrogen replacement for menopause. From a historical perspective, we never needed to worry about it in the past. You were dead by the time you got to menopause. So what to do about what happens after menopause wasn't even really a question. The discovery of hormonal medications only dates back to the, I think, in terms of, you know, commercial use, probably the early 60s. And so the whole idea of, well, what should you do about estrogen replacement in postmenopausal women is only a question that's been asked recently. And there was data that suggested, you know, women have a higher incidence of heart disease after menopause than they did before. Well, maybe it's the absence of the estrogen. And so there was, you know, some preliminary data that suggested maybe estrogen replacement would be beneficial from a cardiovascular standpoint. And then they did longer term, larger population studies and said, well, maybe not. So in that regard, the use of medications for situations where we don't have a lot of information yet is really part of a large population experiment. Mm-hmm. And people need to realize that, you know, when they take medications, to some extent, they're participating in a large-scale experiment. But as I'm fond of saying, life is an experiment. And, you know, parts of it are successful and sometimes parts of it aren't. But as we get more information, it's important to simply review that information in the context of a given individual's medical situation and decide, is this at least a reasonable thing to do or not?
Questions are welcome here. We're talking about healthcare, and specifically, this is that show, and we do every other month, we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And we built the program into the schedule so that people could have this opportunity to ask kind of general questions about healthcare. And as I always say, he has people of all ages in his practice, little ones, big ones, and deals with people who have a variety of complaints and health issues. He's the first stop guy. He's the guy you see first. So if you have questions, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Bloomington, Indiana. We have a caller here, line number four. Hello.
Hi. May I ask about blood circulation in the feet of the elderly?
Certainly.
I'm 69 years old, And I noticed that when the temperature gets really warm, over 90 degrees, as it was a week or so ago, and it stayed that high for several days, I noticed that my feet swell, as if they weren't getting, well, the blood wasn't circulating properly. Since the temperature went back down, no problem. Feet feel just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
a symptom of poor circulation? The answer is no. In fact, that's an attempt by your body to bring the blood vessels of the body closer to the surface of the skin in order to radiate heat.
Oh.
And as those blood vessels come closer to the surface of the skin and also open, they become a little leakier, and extra fluid will indeed leak out of those blood vessels. The other thing that happens during that really warm weather is your body will try and retain a little extra salt, because it knows that you're going to lose some salt through perspiration as a result of the warmer weather. But salt retention causes a little fluid retention as well, and just due to gravity, a lot of that fluid will end up in your feet. But this is in and of itself in no way an indication of poor circulation.
Well, there's a little complication that I have. During that period of hot weather, I was riding my bicycle, and I dismounted a little bit awkwardly, and one of the pedals struck my ankle. And no big deal. The fact is, I wasn't even aware that I'd been struck, except several hours later, I noticed I had a bruise.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the same foot, and the foot, was swollen some. And it seemed like an extremely minor bruise that didn't. It should have gone away very quickly, but instead, the black and blue area formed down near the instep of my foot,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to heal very slowly. It's doing just fine now, but is that a legitimate complication of this process?
If this occurred while you were during this really warm period, you would actually be expected to bruise a little bit more than during colder weather, simply because the blood vessels are dilated and you're going to get more leakage at the site of trauma.
Oh, okay.
So basically, a warm weather bruise is going to be bigger than a cold weather bruise, simply because the blood vessels during warm weather are dilated and more likely to leak fluid. And the fact that it bruised is an indication that you did indeed hurt something.
Yes.
Because that's blood that's leaked into the skin. And that's why the typical treatment for any kind of minor injury is usually to elevate the affected part, put something really cold on it, because what you're trying to do is to try and prevent blood vessels from dilating, swelling, and dumping more fluid into that area. And by elevating it, you're attempting to, again, negate gravity and not have fluid accumulate there.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone on a cell phone. This is on our line number one. Hello.
Yes. My father is a diabetic, and the doctor recommended that he take a low-dose aspirin. What milligram of aspirin do you recommend for such a patient that has cardiovascular risk factors?
Okay. In general, in the absence of known cardiovascular disease, for preventive reasons, the dose that is the equivalent of a child's aspirin, which is 81 milligrams, is the currently recommended dose.
Well, why I ask is because I've read some articles about resistance to aspirin, and that it occurs approximately 25% of the time, and I was wondering at the low dose, but at the higher dose, there wasn't seem to be nearly as much resistance to inhibition of platelets.
But there's more likelihood of easy bruising and bleeding with the larger doses. So on a strictly preventive basis, in the absence of known vascular disease, they're still recommending the lower dose.
Even in people that are diabetic that have high rates of cardiovascular disease?
The key there is to control the other cardiovascular risk factors, which would be to try and normalize the blood sugar. Very, very important to keep the blood pressure optimal, which is less than 130 over 80 these days, and also to avoid sort of self-induced cardiovascular risks such as excess tobacco and alcohol, and then to make sure that cholesterol levels are optimal as well. But the debate over whether it should be an adult aspirin versus a baby aspirin still goes on. In the absence of a cardiovascular disease, they're recommending the lower dose. The full dose is often used in individuals who have had known cardiovascular disease. But for right now, the lower dose is still the recommended one.
Is there a test that can be taken to see if you have resistance to aspirin?
There are tests of platelet aggregation and inhibition that can be done in special hematology laboratories, but I'm not aware of any general test otherwise to look for that.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The general theory behind this business of taking a low dose aspirin, that does that have to do with the fact that aspirin is a blood thinner, and that's what
it's not a blood thinner in the sense that Coumadin or warfarin or heparin is a blood thinner, but it does seem to prevent platelet aggregation. And part of the process of, as people refer to it, plugging up their blood vessels seems to be aggregations of platelets on the inside lining of the blood vessel wall that then become places where cholesterol also tends to accumulate. And it's thought that if you can inhibit the process of platelets aggregating along the blood vessel wall, you can minimize the chances of other things sticking to the blood vessel wall as well.
And is that something now some physicians are actually prescribing?
I would say that it's a fairly standard recommendation for individuals who are perhaps by family history at risk for cardiovascular disease, or who themselves may have several risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as, diabetes or high blood pressure or problems with their cholesterol, to go ahead and recommend the one essentially baby aspirin, an 81 milligram dose on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. And would you? I expect you would suggest that people just not just do this though, if that they would. Something they'd be good to talk about with their doctor.
Yeah, I think it's a very reasonable thing to discuss with their physician. Anything that's being taken on a long-term basis is probably, a good thing to discuss.
Okay. Questions are welcome. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic. He's a family practice doctor. This is that program we call Talk to the Family Doctor, so it's open to whatever you want to talk about. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Since we have had this summer some really hot weather, I'm sure people have heard the advice that if you're going to be outside, you're going to be exerting yourself. You want to make sure you stay hydrated, and I think the easiest way to do that is water.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are people who would like to sell us special kinds of things to do that. What's your take on sports drinks, and is that really any better than just plain water?
It depends on whether you're eating or not. If you are eating regularly during the course of your exertion, water's probably fine. If, on the other hand, you're not eating, you are indeed losing a fair amount of salt along with the water in your system, and simply replacing the water by itself is not quite adequate. Now, in the sort of olden days, they would give you salt tablets, which basically probably aren't recommended anymore because that was a little too much. But a lot of the sports drinks do have a good mixture of some of the salts that are lost with exertion. And if you're exerting yourself and not eating, would probably actually be better than water. Or some combination of the two.
So what if you? So this is. It sounds like this is sort of going beyond just the amount of exertion you were doing. If you're out and it's a really hot day and you're cutting the grass and doing yard work and you're
if you go out and mow the yard and then come in and have a couple glasses of water, you're probably going to be fine. But if you're a football player in pads and you're doing 3-a-day drills, you're probably going to need more than just water.
Okay. Well, again, we're open to whatever questions you have. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You want to give us a call. Something, you know, we were talking earlier about this business of side effects and prescription medications. And I guess one of the things I was thinking about was how it is people decide, and maybe that's difficult, how it is they decide when to raise the issue when they actually think they are having something that it's unusual and it's related to the medication. Mm-hmm. Because you could be taking a medication and you could be taking medication, you could have a headache, you could have diarrhea, you could have dizziness.
Right.
And it could have nothing to do with that medication.
Right.
When do you start to say to yourself, well, maybe this is medication related and you at least want to ask somebody, check in with somebody about it, pharmacist, physician, whatever.
In most instances, side effects related to medication are going to be persistent. Okay? Now, there are some side effects related to medication that we sort of anticipate and tell people you'll probably notice X or Y or Z when you first start taking the medication, but they should go away. And if they don't go away, then you should probably give us a call. Or alternatively, if something that you really haven't experienced in the past now seems to be happening fairly regularly ever since you started this new medication, then it's probably a reasonable thing to make your physician aware of. The usual test is to stop taking the medication, see if that thing goes away. In some instances, people think they're having side effects with their medication. They stop their medication, and they still have the same sensations. We can be pretty reassuring that if you're not taking the medication, you're probably not having side effects from it. And then that's not it. But in other instances, people say, I've done my own little experiment. I stopped taking it. Whatever I noticed went away. I started taking my medication again, and it came back. Well, the more times you can do that, the less likely it is just chance that's the reason for it. So in some instances, people are aware of side effects, and they say, but the benefits that I get from my medication are so wonderful, and the side effect is so minimal, I want to continue with it. And again, that gets into that whole process of, what's the pros and what's the cons, how much benefit versus how much side effect am I willing to put up with.
Okay. Well, we got some other folks here who have questions. We'll get to them. Champagne is first in line, line number one.
Hi. I appreciated your comments on water, and I always drink water, but my question is, how about sun tea? Then I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Tea is a fine beverage, but I don't think I would recommend using it as my primary source of fluid replacement, simply because tea generally contains both caffeine and what are called theoxanthines, and these are stimulant chemicals that also have some diuretic effect. So the net effect of drinking, coffee, tea, is that you may actually end up losing more fluid than you took in. To have a glass of tea on a hot day is fine, but I don't think I would recommend tea as my primary replacement fluid.
Okay, because of the caffeine. I suppose if it's herbal tea and it's got no caffeine.
Well, the theoxanthines are still in there as well.
Oh, okay. If it's
even in decaf.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And same thing, I suppose, applies to alcohol. It has that
Alcohol actually has a direct effect in the body to cause diuresis or loss of fluid. So, no, the net effect of alcohol is is negative,
right? Okay.
Not positive.
So again, good argument for if you want to use one of the sports drinks, that's fine. But the easiest, most basic thing is just plain water.
That's correct.
All right. To Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm not calling about this particular thing, but with regard to caffeine, there was a short article or a section of an article in Consumer Reports on Health that was talking about water and said that the studies on whether caffeine caused you to lose more water than you took in were done on people that didn't normally drink caffeine, and that further studies show that people who normally drink it don't have that diuretic effect.
There's a lessening of that effect in people who habitually use it.
So they said you can count coffee and tea as part of your fluid intake. But the reason I was calling, Consumer Reports on Health also had an article on statins several over time, and the upshot of the two articles I've looked at were that if you need less than 40% reduction in cholesterol levels, that it made sense to start with generic lovastatin, which has been around for a long time, has a proven safety record, and you could start with 10 milligrams instead of what doctors usually start you at, which is 20 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it happened, I just have started on a prescription version, not a prescription version, a non-generic version of lovastatin, which is Altaprev, which my understanding is the basic difference is that it's long-acting.
Right.
So I presume that means slow release.
Right.
And it's expensive. So I'm wondering what you, if you happen to know whether anything about the two, the difference between the two, and I'm just wondering whether I should go back to my doctor and say, how about if we try just 10 milligrams of lovastatin and see.
I think from a general perspective, it's always reasonable in the absence of extenuating circumstances to start with the lowest dose of the most commonly studied medication and see how people do. The goal isn't to get people on as much medication as you can. The goal is to have them on the smallest amount of medication that controls whatever condition you're trying to affect. And so I think your request is a perfectly reasonable one. And basically in 6 to 8 weeks of taking, 10 milligrams of lovastatin, you can have your lipids rechecked. And if that's working for you, then that's fine. That's all you need. On the other hand, if it's not working, then that's a different story, and you're either going to have to up the dose or change the type of medication in an attempt to get a better result. Regardless of which medication in that class of medication you use, you're still going to have some surveillance of liver functions and also whether or not you're having anything that you think is a side effect of the medication. And just like with other people and other medications, some people do well with one and not with another. And it's just a matter of trying to find out individually what you feel best with and what gets the cholesterol down into the range you're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your plan is quite reasonable.
They also apparently worked, but they didn't include the details when they sent me the report of the follow-up blood test. Well, next time I see her, I may just send her a note and say, how about if we do this?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. Oh, by the way, if anybody wants to, I found some of this information when I used Google and typed in lovastatin versus Altaprev, and one of the websites was CR Best Buy Drugs, which was Consumer Reports' article on various drugs that were the best for your money, depending on your situation.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a really good chart and explaining what to recommend based on the degree of cholesterol leveling people needed. So if they wanted, if people, if listeners would like to look for that and have internet access, there is some stuff on the web. Thanks a bunch.
All right, thank you. Let's continue. And Marshall is next. This is caller on line number 3.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I just thought I would share a little experience I've had with my health that might have broad application to listeners, and maybe Dr. Swearingen could comment more fully on it. Like a lot of people, I have high blood pressure that's been hard to treat. 58, and for the past 10 years, I've been trying this medication and that. I don't smoke. I'm not overweight. I exercise. It's been very frustrating. But finally, have got some medication, trial and error, that a combination of 2 or 3 things and low doses that have helped me. But even at that, my blood pressure still is a little above what you'd like it to be, 120 over 80, you know. But I've been satisfied with it. Well, this summer, I got Meniere's disease, and I was put on a low-sodium diet, and this is almost a blessing in disguise. I went on below 1,000 milligrams a day, and I thought, oh, this won't be too hard to do. I don't add salt at the table, and I don't eat much processed foods. But when I actually started counting the milligrams,
mm-hmm.
I could not believe it.
Yep.
My calculator out, I could not believe how much sodium I was ordinarily ingesting.
That's great.
So I did do this, and I have been. And I happened to take my blood pressure, and it was in the 90s over the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It had such a profound effect on my blood pressure, and I was so naive about how much salt I was actually getting. I really thought that I was already on a fairly low salt diet because I didn't add salt and didn't eat a lot of salty food. So that might be something for your listeners who are having trouble to try. I mean, even Jell-O has salt in it.
Your observation is quite accurate. It is estimated that the average American diet, before you pick up the salt shaker, already contains 10 times the amount of sodium that your body actually needs on a daily basis. And this is a function of the fact that our diet is mostly what we buy in the grocery store, as opposed to, you know, eating things that just freshly came out of the field. And as such, when people think that they're, you know, gee, I don't use the salt shaker, I must be on a low-sodium diet, they're not even close. The biggest problem is that many people who are used to salt in their food then find their diet unpalatable.
Oh, it's very bland, but I think it's a habit. I'm starting to get used to it. But the difficult thing is you almost have to cook for yourself,
yes.
And you have to cook from scratch.
Right.
You have to make your own sauces, you can get your own salad dressing. You can use almost no canned goods. I guess you can rinse some of your vegetables.
Right.
And there are some out there, you know, corn and tomatoes you can find with no salt added, but not an awful lot. And eating out is a nightmare.
Right.
And I just feel, I bet this is the reason there is so very much high blood pressure.
Well, you are correct, and your observations are very accurate. If you can indeed lower your sodium intake, you can make a significant difference in your blood pressure.
Well, I just thought I would share that. Maybe it would be helpful to some of the viewers. It's just very difficult to do.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, and as part of Focus 580, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is that program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. He is here every other month, and we make it just a general kind of forum for you to discuss your health concerns. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
One thing I wanted to mention to you, David, she mentioned, our last caller did, that she was on 2 to 3 medications at low dose for her blood pressure. And I just wanted to point out to our listeners that this is a relatively new philosophy in the management of hypertension. I'm going to restrict my comments to medications. I will tell people that, you know, if you can exercise, if you can reduce your sodium, if you can lose some weight, if you can give up smoking and excess caffeine and alcohol, your blood pressure will get better as well. But, you know, with the assumption that somebody's made the appropriate lifestyle changes and they have a genetic tendency toward high blood pressure and they need to be on medication, in the past it used to be thought that you would simply start with a medication, check the blood pressure, and then just keep pushing the dose up higher and higher to get better control of the blood pressure. In some respects, that does work, but you also find that most side effects, as we've been talking about before, are dose-related. Most side effects are dose-related, and the higher the dose you take, the more likely you are to experience side effects. So in the last few years, there's been more of a push to educate physicians to think about using combinations of medication at low dose. And what that allows you to do is to pick medications that, from a chemical standpoint, work synergistically and minimize the chances of side effects by not using large doses. And this is actually, I think, in my experience, been working out very, very well.
Okay. We have one other caller here, at least one other. We got in the time that remains here, someone in Piatt County on our toll-free line. Right here, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. My brother is undergoing chemo at the present for colon cancer, and he's also diabetic. He's in his 60s. And he said that the food list that they gave him for the effects of chemo were so much carbo-based, donuts and bread and things like that. And so I was just wondering, and I haven't asked him, you know, I'd like to let him do it on his own, but I'm just wondering, would it be beneficial to see a nutritionist?
Very.
You know,
very
because,
beneficial.
Because he had been working out, and then he said he's gotten so tired. Are there nutritionists who specialize in this, or would you just see a nutritionist? And
if he's at a cancer center, they may be able to direct him to a dietitian or nutritionist with more expertise or background or experience in dealing specifically with cancer patients. But even if that's not readily available, a good nutritionist or dietitian should be able to help him work through the issue of carbohydrates and his diabetes. Because no, you don't want to trade, you know, the benefits that he gains from his chemo for worsening of his diabetes. There may be some temporary, you know, problems, but on an ongoing basis, I think it would be very, very helpful for him to sit down with somebody specifically and go over the specifics of his diet.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Thanks for the call. Again, here I'm sure we could get maybe one caller, possibly two, real quick, if you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that I've been thinking more about, we had some conversation, a lot of conversation here this morning about prescription medicine, and but we have another caller. So I won't ask
thought.
My question. I'll save that thought. Chicago here, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hello. I have a question on the use of diuretics. If you're taking diuretic, is there a danger if you're on a low-sodium diet and taking a diuretic at the same time of perhaps mineral deficiencies? Or, you know, do you need to take a multiple vitamin, perhaps, or extra vitamin C or something to compensate for the loss of minerals in your system or sodium?
Diuretic-type medications can be associated with a decrease in, number one, potassium. And so either increasing the amount of potassium in your diet on a regular basis or a low-dose potassium supplement is sometimes recommended. It's less common to see a drop in sodium, and our regular table salt is sodium chloride. So it would be relatively unusual to need to supplement sodium, though the loss of potassium is not all that uncommon. And as such, when most individuals are on a diuretic-type medication, Their physicians will periodically check their electrolytes, which is their sodium and their potassium and their chloride, to make sure that it's not becoming a problem. So as long as that's monitored regularly, it shouldn't be a big problem, though if you took, say, extra doses of your diuretic and then worked outside, you know, and got hot and sweaty and dehydrated, you know, you could potentially have a problem.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. And one more here, Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Okay, I'll make this quick. I'm a Nicorette user. Anytime there's a physical or medical forms, it always asks, are you a smoker? I mean, what if you chew tobacco or use a lot of Nicorette? I mean, I realize there's carcinogens in smoke, but nicotine's, you know, not good for the body. Why don't they have a check box for nicotine user?
I'm not sure that that's become a standard question on there. The usual question has been changed from, do you smoke, to do you use tobacco? Because that'll take into effect, you know, the guy who chews or snuffs or, you know, that sort of thing.
What if you're taking in 50 milligrams of nicotine through Nicorette?
Well, the intent with Nicorette is that you're not going to be on it forever. It's generally recommended to be used for a short, finite period of time to aid you to get off of whatever form of tobacco you're using, and it's not intended to be a long-term use.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Well, at that, I think we will finish up for this time around. With the promise that in a couple months, Dr. Swearingen will be back, so I guess that would be October.
I'll be here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Very much. Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is with us every other month, always on a Monday, for this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor.